We did our first week on video week ago, last week's episode.
Video killed the radio star.
Our 275th episode was on video. And we didn't reference it because we didn't want to mess it up, you know?
We were trying it out. If it all failed, we'd just push it over to next week.
Yeah, and I think we were both happy with it. So the next challenge in the future at some point is to do live video. So we'll get there too. And we tend to record like 5 Eastern on Thursday. So if that's something you anticipate, then mark your calendar. But yeah, it would, I hope if you didn't know about it, then check 9to5Mac's YouTube at youtube.com/9to5Mac. It will be there this week as well. And
we'll still be doing audio, obviously. It's just if you want a video version.
That's right.
It's on the YouTube channel.
That's right. We are audio focused. We are doing this so focused that we don't want to mess up the audio quality of the audio podcast. So that will always take precedent to any video production. So, but I think it's kind of cool. Like people have wanted it for a while, especially the live stuff, and we'll get there eventually. But also I think, you know, kind of how I thought about it was when people are more isolated than usual, it's nice to, you know, have that face to a voice and everything.
Yeah, if you're bored at home, you can put it on the TV for a change.
Yeah, and even for me and you, it's different for me to see you as I'm talking because, again, 275 episodes, never did that.
we've done like video chat like offline before and stuff. But
yeah,
it's not.
And like before we record, but then we turn it off to like, you know, preserve bandwidth and everything.
Yeah.
Yeah, so yeah, I hope people like it. If you haven't seen it, check it out.
And one day, Zach, we will meet in person.
Yeah,
that'll just be the final frontier.
I'd say it wasn't in the cards this year, though.
There was talk about me coming to WWDC this year, but we know that all went down.
That's right. We put it out there and everything. Okay, let's talk about some news this week. We've got a lot to talk about, some good topics, good diverse topics. So let's kick it off with the good people at Facebook. What happened this week with Facebook?
Everyone loves Facebook. No, like, I wanted to cover this because it's really easy to do the knee-jerk reaction of Facebook's just a terrible company that you should never support in any way whatsoever. I don't subscribe to that. Like, look, Facebook's done some bad things in the past. A lot of companies have done some pretty awkward things in the past. And yes, they are a company that fundamentally relies on advertising to make money. But they're not that far disposed from any of the other companies that you use on a daily basis that rely on advertising and data collection to make money. So Facebook gets like a pretty bad rap, right? I don't use it that much personally, but, you know, I have a Facebook account. I have it because other people do, right? You know the drill. Mm. And then in this specific case, there was a nice little happening which let everyone come up and pretend like Facebook's the devil again. So what happened in this case is that a load of high-profile applications that, you know, Spotify, TikTok, IMDb, the works, and it wasn't discriminately just these apps. It was basically any app that integrated with the Facebook SDK. So that means that there's a third-party library that Facebook provides that all these apps embed in their application, and that allows Facebook to basically run code inside of the bigger apps. And people use this for like advertising reasons or signing with Facebook. Generally, people want to, when you're doing account setup, they want you to be able to like log in as easy as possible. So you get those different social things with like login with your Google account, login with your Facebook account. And technically, there would be a way where Facebook could expose just like a callback to like a web view, so you wouldn't have to embed all this third-party code. But no company does that because they all want to do data collection, they want to do analytics, so they force you to embed their proprietary SDKs in the little thing, which then can basically do whatever they want under the normal purview of the App Store rules. But if you're an individual app, you don't really know what these third-party SDKs are doing. You just drag and drop them into your project, you make them activate, and then you just trust that they're not going to do anything terrible. In this case, there was a bug which was causing all these apps to just straight crash on launch, which is bad, right? This has actually happened in the past too with Facebook and other things, but this was particularly noticeable because it was affecting such high-profile applications. Now, reasons why an application may want to integrate the Facebook SDK is advertising, possibly, because you can do like Facebook display ads in the app. There is also signing with like the equivalent of signing with Apple, but for signing with Facebook, which is a big reason why a lot of these SDKs have it. And then there's a third reason, which is a bit more obscure, which is if you run Facebook advertising on the web, and those adverts include like a link to your app, right? If you want to get full analytics about your marketing budget being translated into people actually downloading the application, you have to have the Facebook SDK installed, because it correlates, like the cookies from the web, like tapping on the link in Safari, like the advert, gets correlated up when you launch the app and Facebook SDK connects it. And then you can say, okay, I paid X amount and 10 people bought this ad directly. If you don't include the Facebook SDK, you can still run the ads on the website, but you don't get like the same analytics information, because there isn't really any way for Facebook to know if it wasn't embedded. And it sounds kind of creepy, but there isn't really an alternative way to do it. If you are running Facebook ads, you kind of want to know if you're getting a return on your investment, so you don't really have a choice as a small developer. Yeah, it's kind of bad that the status quo is the fact that all of these apps have to include all these random little mini like snippets of random third-party code, but Facebook is not exceptional here, I'd say. Google AdSense is exactly the same. If you want to run Google AdWords, you have to embed stuff in either your website or your application. Snapchat, the lot. They're all identical. It was just awkward that in this case, it highlighted an issue where if those third-party SDKs are written badly and something bad happens, then they can cause problems like instability and crashes. And in this case, what had happened is the Facebook SDK was communicating with Facebook servers and it was expecting a certain data payload in a certain format. For whatever reason, the Facebook servers were sending an erroneous payload in a different format, and that was being badly handled by the SDK, and so it was just causing all the apps to crash indiscriminately. And obviously to an average user, it doesn't pop up and say, the Facebook SDK has crashed, this is the problem for the issue. You know, your app's just crashed and it looks bad on the source application. This was a problem for like all of May the 6th, like probably about 5 hours on May the 6th before it finally started getting resolved. Facebook rolled the server back quite quickly, but it took like longer than that for like the caches to invalidate and for it finally to get out of place. On Twitter, everyone just used this as an immediate firestorm of like, Facebook sucks, everyone should never use Facebook in your life, why were these third-party apps doing all these, you know, embedding these frameworks? The reality is, the status quo is, you know, if you're doing Facebook ads, which you kind of have to survive as a business, right? Even Apple runs Facebook ads, like, for all of Apple's complaints about Facebook being a company that doesn't respect your privacy very well, they still run social media advertising because they have to, and that's called business. And if you want to see the direct conversions of those in your applications, you kind of have to do it. So, you know, as an individual developer, you don't really have a choice. And there was also another part of this where everyone loves to roll up the conspiracy theories, because people found that if you commented out the code in like your application that started this thing off, it would still launch and contact the servers. And yeah, that is kind of not great behavior of the way the API works, but it is fully documented in Facebook's developer documentation, and there is a flag that you can set to make it not do that. It was just people kind of taking it a bit out of proportion. And in a perfect world, there would be a better way for apps to be able to get the kind of analytics information they need to do this stuff without having to like embed this opaque blob of app code that could do literally anything and you don't have any control over it. But that's just not the world we live in.
Mm-hmm. Two questions that you as a developer probably know the answer to. Mm-hmm. One, how much did Facebook pay you to say that? and when does your Facebook portal arrive?
That is quite funny.
Yeah.
Like obviously it's not a great situation, but there isn't really like, I wouldn't say Facebook's any worse than anyone else, right? Like they're all doing the same thing.
Yeah, I was in the attic yesterday doing some work, and it was quite hot, and I was just kind of thinking in my head, you know, and I was thinking back about, you know, kind of the seasons we go into, the cycles we go into when Facebook does something, this was probably what triggered it, stupid, that gets the gears rolling against Facebook and brands go away and people delete their accounts. But then, you know, I was thinking in the situation we've been in this year, They provide a massively big service that helps a lot of people, you know. Mm-hmm. And man, there's one Facebook group that I've seen a lot of family join and invite me to, and it's called, I think like Views from My Front Door or something like that. But it's like the idea is you're quarantined at home, and what is your perspective? Like, what do you see? So we all feel more together. And you know, ideally, there would be a big alternative to the company, you know, maybe with Apple's goals in mind and principles. But I think the utilitarian thing here is that as a company, they provide something, you know, whether it's through their core product or through things like Instagram or WhatsApp, that are extremely beneficial technologies to have, you know, lately. So
yeah, like yeah. The, and you know, if you don't want to be so defeatist about it, it's like, what could Apple do to improve this so that all these apps don't have to have all this random code in them, right? And this is a pervasive thing with Facebook and with loads of these analytics providers, because there isn't really a better way to do it right now.
Right.
And so one option is to offer alternatives. So like, they have started offering signing with Apple, right? And so if your core problem is that you want to make it super easy for users to sign up and log in, if you can offer something like signing with Apple, because obviously that only existed starting this year, basically. So before that, you always had to rely on all these third-party logins to actually make login very seamless, and that increases, you know, user acquisition tremendously. And, you know, that's ultimately what you need to be able to make a sustainable business on the platform. So before, you know, your only options are going to Google and Facebook and the like. But at least now, some apps will be able to go solely on signing with Apple only. And so they won't have to worry about embedding other stuff, because obviously signing with Apple was built into the frameworks, built into the system, and you'd have to embed any random third-party code there. Realistically, that's not going to happen, because, you know, these companies are just going to offer signing with Apple alongside every other option, right? So this is going, and so maybe there's an architectural thing that Apple could start to enforce in the future, where these SDKs have to be made using some kind of like extension architecture, which helps to sandbox them and silo them off for the rest of the app. That has a lot of technical problems, and like, how do you police it? How do you manage it? How does Apple even know that's got what's going on? Because it's hard. It's kind of difficult to, from a like a app review standpoint, to separate the Facebook blob of code from just your application's blob of code. So in terms of actually regulating it, it's hard to think of a way they could do it, but maybe they could, like, you know, support it better with best practices and stuff. And if you go back many years, like back to the old land of iOS 5 iOS 6, and in that timeline, Apple did actually support Facebook natively in the operating system, because they had native social sharing APIs for Twitter and for Facebook. And so you could actually do Facebook social login without using any Facebook code at all. And maybe for these big guys like Twitter and Facebook, maybe that's a solution they could go back to, where like the system has special knowledge about Facebook and Twitter. So if you just want to offer like login options, that you don't have to include this like opaque blob of Facebook code that could be doing anything. Similar for analytics, maybe Apple could just omit the fact that, okay, these companies are going to collect this information one way or the other. Can we offer a route that is more protecting of user privacy and is more efficient to actually get the same information? Like, you know, if the App Store reporting clicks directly back to the developers rather than them having to like wait for the app to install and then send it that way. So there are some policy things that could happen here, but my primary point is the status quo with Facebook is no different to the status quo of any of the other big corporations that offer exactly the same services, because that's just how it runs at the moment, and there's really no leeway there to do anything else.
Yep. All right, let's talk about iOS 13.5, beta 4 or beta 2, however you view it. New update this week that addresses a lot of the stuff in the design of the exposure notification and how that is presented. What's the key change there for you?
Yeah, so last week we spent a decent chunk of time complaining about the fact that the settings screen in settings general privacy does not did not really make it very clear about what you're actually meant to be doing, because like it would just have the toggle for exposure notifications always enabled, but the reality is no data is actually collected until you install a third-party app that integrates with the exposure notification API, so an app that would be supplied by a national institution like a government, and then actually you get another pop-up that asks you if you want to opt into data collection and sharing for exposure notifications. And so the text and the labeling and just the button look really did not convey that properly last week. And there's enough misinformation going around about the exposure notification stuff that Apple shouldn't need to join in the mix as well. Luckily, in this new beta, they've revamped it, and it's much clearer. It grays out the toggle until you download an app that could actually take advantage of it. And there's like another like four paragraphs of text that explain that nothing actually happens until it's enabled. When it's enabled, the Bluetooth identifiers are exchanged, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And I just went to it right now on my phone, which is running the beta, and it actually says not available in your country, and it just grays everything else out. But it has the description below. And that's obviously in preparation for the fact that Apple has controls at the server-side level to turn it on and off for each region.
That's right.
So they can. If the UK finally get around to supporting the Apple and Google sanctioned API for contact tracing, which apparently they're investigating, that was a report this week, wasn't it? They're looking into it. They will be able to, you know, turn on the UK, support the app, and then in a year's time when we don't need it anymore, fingers crossed, they'll be able to turn it off so that no one can actually collect that information any longer.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So that was a good change. I mean, there was definitely confusion even internally from my interactions. And so, yeah, it's a good change. Something else that we learned this week is that the Apple Watch and iPhone is a new feature sort of born out of this pandemic situation. But it's a feature that could have existed before and would have been useful. To exist now is good. And unlike the exposure notification, this feature won't go away when things are better, because it has a benefit forever. And what the feature is it kind of combines medical ID and emergency SOS, which are two features that you have on the iPhone and Apple Watch. And medical ID is where you give the health app information about yourself, like your name and date of birth and address, any health conditions you have, any medications you have, your blood type, that sort of stuff. And the idea there is if you're in the hospital or you're in an ambulance and you can't communicate that information out, then paramedics are trained to look on your iPhone. It's encrypted, it's locked, it's on your iPhone. And you can access this, but nothing else on your iPhone. And the same for the Apple Watch, where even if your watch is locked, you can hold the side button down and have the option to view medical ID. And what that gives you is the person can see basically what would be on a license plus much more. And so that's very useful. The other feature that works separately until now is called emergency SOS. And on the Apple Watch, what that does is you can hold the side button down for several seconds and then you can call 911 or local emergency services based on your region. With the Series 5, it even changes to what region you're in. So that's a cool thing. But they haven't been connected before. and it's one of those features where once it's out, once you see it, you're like, oh, why wasn't this done already?
Yeah, because they did something like a year ago where they paired up with the new like location provider, right? So that it could, the emergency services, when you called SOS, would be able to get your GPS location directly.
Yep. And so what the change is now coming in iOS 13.5 and watchOS 6.2.5 is the ability to connect medical ID and emergency SOS together. What will happen is if you use emergency SOS, so you hold on the side button, I think on your iPhone for several seconds or on your Apple Watch for several seconds, it'll, you know, do a countdown and then call local emergency services. And if you're in an area that supports enhanced emergency data, then it will also send your medical ID. And the reason it has to have that is because it's encrypted. So you don't want the information just to be sent out without the encryption, you know, kept. But if you're in an area that supports that, then the first responder on the other end of the phone call won't necessarily need to ask you, you know, who are you? Where are you? You know, are you allergic to anything? Are you on any medication? Do you have any conditions?
Sure.
They'll just have that in front of them and they can skip to essential information and cut down on call times. And that's pretty cool. So it's something that you can set up. You know, you give permission for this. It doesn't just work automatically, but you give permission for this. And then right from then and there, like the idea is that emergency responders, first responders will be able to, just based on the number of people using this, shorten call times and be able to help more people faster. And
that's really cool. Like, especially with like, you know, like Apple Watch, where if you have a hard fall, it can start calling the emergency service automatically if you don't move, right? And it works out you're unconscious. And so then the caller, the handler on the other end of the line would immediately get your medical ID information, which might say, you know, you've had a history of diabetes, so you might have passed out, et cetera, et cetera. So that it's like an extension of the existing system where they would send across your location. Now it's location plus your medical information.
Yeah. And if you haven't set a medical ID or emergency SOS, both are great to have. And so I'd recommend setting them up, and we'll have the resources in the show notes for how to do that. And then whenever you update to the new software updates that we expect in mid-May, a little bit later, then this will be an option there as well. So it's a cool thing. And you know, it's one of those things where this would have made sense before, it will make sense long after, and it's, you know, good to see it.
Yeah, it's probably something they had in development, but they prioritized because of you know, the current pandemic situation.
Yeah, and it just shows like one more thing in this 13.5 update that's focused on the situation at hand.
Especially in times like right now of lockdown, you should be avoiding going out for grocery shopping wherever possible. And Sunbasket is a perfect and delicious solution to do just that. Sunbasket delivers healthy, delicious meals straight to your door. It offers recipes for all kinds of dietary preferences, like paleo, Mediterranean, vegetarian, gluten-free, and so much more. And Sunbasket makes it easy and convenient to cook. Everything you need is delivered to your door, with all ingredients appropriately portioned ahead of time and ready to prep and cook. You can enjoy a dinner full of organic produce in as little as 15 minutes. Current recipes include hoisin steak strip, lettuce cups with pickled daikon and carrots, roasted salmon with miso glazed eggplant, that sounds nice, black bean tostadas, diablo with cabbage slaw, and guacamole. And recipes are easy and simple to follow, so anyone can use Sunbasket no matter how much experience they have in the kitchen. And now, Zach, Sunbasket sent you a meal basket, right?
Yeah, yeah. There's a couple of stories here. So one is that I finished working a few days ago, and my brother's here with us, and he said the kids are sitting on a box outside. I guess it's okay. And so I looked out there. This is the box from Sunbasket. It's like, oh, It turns out it can survive a 2-year-old and a 7-year-old using it as a chair. So, I mean, and that's good to know. Like, you want your food to stay, you know, when it comes to shipping, you want it to stay solid. And then I'm always amazed at how you can have refrigerated and freezered food, you know, shipped like that. And it was so fun to unpack it, because it was like, I was asking my brother, I was like, have you ever seen this before? Like, this kind of thing? And he's like, no, he hasn't. And so it was so neat to be able to take the box from the porch step to the kitchen and pack it away in the freezer, in the refrigerator. And it was packaged so well and like separate that it was just really neat. Very, very, very organized. And the next thing I have to say is that my wife, who just, you know, she takes pride in preparing meals and everything, and like, I can make ramen, but she's like, oh, you signed up for Sunbasket. And I was like, well, they've got them for a sponsor for this show, so we're trying it out. And she's like, oh, I've been wanting to try them for a while. So she was impressed that we have Sunbasket as a sponsor. And like, frankly, I hadn't heard of Sunbasket before the sponsorship, which I imagine is true for some listeners. But you know, it was a great way to impress her. She really was. Nice. So yeah. And so my brother will be cooking for us tonight. And, I'm looking forward to trying it.
Great. Sunbasket facilities have the highest levels of food and employee safety. And in the wake of COVID-19, Sunbasket is reinforcing its strict adherence to its operating procedures and increasing how regularly it sanitizes offices and distribution centers. And right now, Sunbasket is offering $35 off your order when you go to sunbasket.com/happyhour and enter promo code happyhour as all one word at checkout. That's sunbasket.com, sunbasket.com/happyhour. Remember, that's all one word, and enter promo code happyhour at checkout for $35 off your order. sunbasket.com/happyhour, promo code happyhour. Thanks to Sunbasket for sponsoring the show.
All right, Mayo, news this week about WWDC, Apple's Worldwide Developer Conference. This time it's truly worldwide in its form. What have you learned this week about WWDC, the new virtual Worldwide Developers Conference from Apple?
Well, last month, we had the incredible knowledge that WWDC would take place in June.
Oh.
Incredible. Who could have guessed that it will take place at some point inside of June?
I mean, that it wasn't July.
I mean, I guess in the current climate, anything's up for debate. But, yes. You know, it was going to be sometime in June.
And it wasn't going to be in person.
And it wasn't going to be in person. That was big news before, right? But now in May, we have now got a slightly more refined date, because Apple has announced that it will not just be in June. It will be starting on June 22nd, which is the last full week of June. So basically, the last possible date they could have picked in June is when they are hosting WWDC this year. Obviously, it's going to be the all online event. They did not disclose any further information about the schedule. Instead, they actually said that info, including details about the keynote, the State of the Union, sessions and labs, will be shared in June. So we've got a few more weeks before we actually know for sure the layout and the schedule.
Yeah.
If you look at tradition, the keynote's always held on the first day of the conference, so that would be the Monday, i.e. June 22nd. And, you know, technically that's not confirmed here, but it's unlikely to change, because they use the Monday keynote to show off iOS 14, to show off the new versions of macOS.
And they, in the press release, they mentioned developers are encouraged to download the Apple Developer app or additional WWDC 20 program information, including keynote and platform State of the Union details. sessions and labs and more will be shared in June. So we know there will be a keynote. There will be a
there will be a keynote.
There will be labs.
Probably so. On Monday.
Yeah, probably the beginning of the whole thing.
Technically, they haven't said it. Yeah. You know, I don't know why they didn't say it was on Monday, because it, you know, it doesn't make sense to do it any other day, because they share, you know, they do the product presentation essentially for all the big features and all the software stuff on the first day, and then the rest of the week's the developer implementation and technical nitty-gritty. Mm-hmm. So basically, we can pencil in Monday for being the June 22nd keynote. Mm-hmm. Obviously, we don't really know what form the keynote's going to be. It could be a pre-recorded video, right, where they just do like product videos that have been shot and edited and they're not even set in a stage, right? Because, you know, like that video they sent to press for the iPad and Magic Keyboard, mm-hmm. with Craig Federighi just like in a room in Apple Park, and it was clearly edited together and he just showed off the features and he talked it through. Like, theoretically, they don't have to do a keynote live. They could just pre-record everything, have it perfectly done with like perfect editing and perfect cuts. I think it'd be a bit weird if they did that. Like, maybe they'll just do a pre-recorded keynote, but it's still just set on a stage and they just have like no one in the audience.
You're not going to get Tim Cook coming out and saying good morning and everyone clapping in the background. Like, you know, there's a couple of late night shows I watch, and one does a fake laugh track, and then they play off of it by having like black and white crowds clapping and things like that. So it's obviously fake, but it's kind of like reassuring. It's kind of like back to normal. And then another one, late show with Stephen Colbert, did a thing where he fell asleep at the beginning of the show, and then he dreamed that things were back to normal, and he was back in his studio in New York doing a show in front of a live audience, but it was animated, and that like, and it actually That's felt better than like seeing him, you know, in a corner of his house doing the show. Imagine a Memoji.
That is the artwork.
Keynote. Yeah,
that is the artwork. They've got three laptops, and behind them they've got different people's Memoji characters. Like, maybe I think that'd be a bit too cheesy for Apple.
Yeah. Like, when they went to commercial break on the Late Show, they went back to the, you know, mid person.
If I had to guess, they'll probably do some sort of like keynote that's on a stage. Maybe it's not live; it's recorded, and they just use like they get a small smattering of Apple employees, like the executive team, to be in the audience and do the clapping, and they can just use some creatively positioned microphones to make it sound like it's more fuller. Right.
Sure. Yeah.
Because I think you need like, I don't think you could do a keynote where the audience is literally empty, because, you know, they put in jokes and they put in little gags and they, you know, they wait, they pause for applause and stuff. And so if you just have like dead silence, it's probably not going to fly. But if you just have like, you know, the 10 people or whatever around the thing, they can, technically it's not canned laughter or canned applause, but they can, you know, do the juice it up so it sounds more fuller than it, you know, so it doesn't sound awkward, if you know what I mean.
And maybe there's a reason we haven't heard the keynote date officially, even though we presume it's, you know, the morning of June 22nd. And it's because it depends on what the state of affairs are on June 22nd and what they
can, I mean, they've definitely given themselves the longest opportunity for stuff to change. And if lockdown measures are eased slightly by the end of June, that maybe they can put on something more substantial, or maybe not, or maybe they don't want to because of health concerns.
Like, I've kind of thought that the notion that they would invite press, even local press, is just too optimistic.
Yeah, I agree. Like, maybe back in like February, when we were all still a bit naive about the whole thing, it was like, or you know, early March, it was like, oh, maybe by June they'll be able to invite local press. Like, you know, we were like a month and a half away, and it doesn't seem like they're going to invite anyone externally.
I don't think people will be traveling by plane for this.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
It's going to be... Because, like, obviously, most of Apple is working from home.
Yeah.
But there has to be people on the campus doing stuff, because there are essential tasks that have to be done on site and they keep it on the down low. But there are, you know, actual employees in the offices, you know, doing server maintenance, making sure the build systems are still running, making sure all the stuff that all the machines and the prototypings in the room. Like, when you log in remotely as a person at home, you're logging into a remote machine that exists somewhere in Apple Park. If there's a problem with that machine, they have to get the technical people, they have to get IT to go and sort it out. Like, there are actual people in Apple Park, like far less than the 10,000 or whatever there normally is, but there must be a few hundred. They could just fill out the crowd with them if they have to, right? Like, and they're not technically exposing anyone else to more risks than they need to, because they're already there anyway. So I think there's some creative ways they could get around, you know, doing a keynote like that and it still being in a stage environment, if you know what I mean.
Could be imagine if it's all the executives from their homes. Like, Tim Cook does these videos on Twitter where he's like, hey, it's Tim, you know, and he's got his basketballs in the background, like, you know,
it's a group FaceTime call with face zooming disabled, because
it's gonna be interesting what happens here. I mean, just to see how it all unfolds, because it is so different this year. They do have this new thing that's the Swift student challenge for developers 13 and up. And they describe that by saying, this is the only way you can get a jacket, which is ordinarily included with your paid ticket, and a pen set, which has been kind of a new tradition in the past few years. But they say about the Swift Student Challenge is showcase your love of coding by creating an incredible Swift playground on the topic of your choice. Only winners will receive an exclusive WWDC 20 jacket and pen set. The challenge is open to students around the world. So it's kind of neat because it's free this time. Ordinarily, I think you need to attend, right? And it's usually
the student scholarships are always free.
Okay, but you get one by submitting an app, right?
In normal years, you can either buy a ticket for $1,600,
yeah,
and then you get a jacket as part of that swag, right? So if you just come as a normal person, and then they have about 200 to 300 student scholarship applications, where you submit a little project, you submit a Swift Playground, and then if you get in, they pay for your ticket, and in many cases, they pay for your travel as well. So this Swift student challenge is kind of the equivalent of the scholarship thing, but Obviously there's no travel involved.
That's right. And only the students will get jackets and pens.
So. Yeah, that is true, because no one else will be getting... So they'll be pretty damn rare.
And then they can sell them and pay for college. Because they're that rare.
Yep. So that's kind of like keynote admin stuff. Like at a high level, what do you think they're going to do? What do you think they're going to announce, right? Like, is there anything? Obviously, they're going to announce the operating systems, but Do you think there's like big things? Like the ARM Mac is a question, right? Is it the time for the ARM Mac?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, my thought on that is that, you know, there's some reporting about the project for next year being the first MacBook to come out with it. You know, there's been so much discussion over the decade about this and how it could go. My only thing to say is that they've kept things like the Swift programming language a secret, so that I could see them keeping this tightly held too. So this could, you know, as like a prepare
surprise.
Yeah, as like, you know, we're giving you this much to prepare, you know, time to prepare. Here's the next phase of what was once known as Marzipan Catalyst, you know, and then here's this other thing to focus on as well.
I could see it because, like, let's say they say that the first they could just say our first product with ARM will be shipping in the spring of the next year, right? Mm-hmm. So that gives developers and the community, you know, 9 months to get their software updated, to get it ready. Mm-hmm. That, and if they're not going to do emulation, which remains an open question whether they're going to offer an emulation option or not, if they're not going to, they need to give people preparation time to.
They shouldn't.
Yeah, I don't think they should do emulation.
Yeah.
But if you say just like very vaguely, like, oh, we will have ARM products next year, it kind of cuts off most of the like the Osborne effect of the cannibalization, right? Because if they said like, they're not going to announce we're going to do a 12-inch MacBook with ARM and it's going to come out in March.
Yeah.
Because then loads of people stop buying MacBook Airs. If they just say, you know, generally, we're starting an ARM transition with the Mac. Here's our developer machine that you can buy from Apple.com for developers to actually test their software, right? And that's kind of what they did with the Intel transition when they went from PowerPC to Intel all those years ago. They didn't announce Intel products on the same day. They announced a developer, you know, machine, basically, that was kind of like a Mac Pro, but it was just running Intel and nothing else. And then they followed up by starting to release Intel products at the next event, which was like 4 months later or 9 months later or whatever. So they could do history repeating themselves. I think if they didn't say anything about ARM Macs at all until the spring when the laptop came out,
it doesn't instill confidence.
Yeah, I think they would have a more... The software situation would be in much more dire shape. Although maybe they could get away with it. Like, if it is... Because if they are going to start with, like, the cheapest end entry-level MacBook Air equivalent, 12-inch MacBook equivalent, they're not going to need all the big companies on board to have a compelling product. You know, most people are spending their life in Messages and Safari, so even just a MacBook that runs those apps is close enough. If you get like Office on board, though, it definitely helps. And
well, and you've got the iPad stuff, so yeah, you could work privately with the major groups, and then you could say, you know, like to take Office from being the Mac version to being the iPad version on the Mac, that could be a big deal. I'm not sure how the feature parity changes there. And also believe that it's we've seen in the past Office lag behind on the Mac, in terms of features.
But they could do like both, right? You could have like Office 365 equivalents on like the Catalyst versions, right? Transpired.
Perpetual license on the Mac with Intel, or subscription based on ARM or the Mac with Intel, basically.
Yeah, and then it doesn't have to be like a permanent thing, and they can say, look, we've got these ones which work exactly like the iPad apps, but then we're still working on transferring the old classic full Office suite over to ARM eventually, if you know what I mean. Like,
yeah.
So if Apple, you know, did some private dealings, they could say, yeah, the iPad app, just make that, you know, work all right on the Mac for the time being.
What's phase two of Catalyst, as reported by Mark Gurman before, where first you target iPad apps?
The second phase is targeted more at phone apps, so it would be easier for iPhone-style apps to be ported to the Mac, and so you'd have, like, a calculator app, but it doesn't have to be, like, a landscape application. It can just be a little portrait.
The Twitter app for the iPad is, like, it's good. I don't. It's weird because I guess it doesn't force you in landscape. You know, you can make a tiny little timeline column.
Yeah, so yeah, like that. That's why that second phase of Mark's reporting has always been a bit ambiguous, because you can force Catalyst now to like only have a window that's so wide. I think it's more the fact that like the supporting tooling for it isn't really meant for it. Like they want you to use the iPad layouts, like the landscape big width layouts.
We haven't seen Apple do an iPhone only app on the Mac, and I guess there's some apps that are just like they I don't know, it's hard to imagine an app that's on the iPhone that wouldn't be ideal on the iPad but is ideal on the Mac. Like that's I can't say that being a thing, but maybe.
Well, I think there's probably apps that are only on the phone, like Instagram, that they might want to get on the Mac.
Yeah, but they could do Instagram for iPads usually. They could do Instagram for Catalyst. Like.
Yeah, like I think there's probably just like some like Xcode features and support and like automatic transferring to make it really easy for like an iPhone layout to be able to go to the Mac directly one shot. Whereas right now you more have to go around the houses, and it's like you get your iPad layout for free, but you don't get anything else, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
Apart from ARM stuff, there's probably going to be some kind of services update. The media bundle stuff that we keep hearing about probably is a September thing, you'd expect, but I think they could do some. There'll be like new features for Apple Arcade, maybe new features for the TV stuff. Then the widgets, home screen widgets, are a forerunning rumor for like iOS 14 in general, right? We'll definitely cover more in terms of like iOS features.
We know a lot of what's been in the work since last December, and we've reported that on the site, on the podcast. So
yeah, the wallpapers leaks. You had the kids mode for Apple Watch.
Yeah,
stuff like that.
Our friend Love to Dream on Twitter has had one more thing. It's coming.
Coin did that last year. He was wrong.
Yeah, so it's funny. It's like, oh no, here we go again. But I like jokingly replied that like, yeah, the 5 gigabytes of iCloud will double to 10. But seriously, like any change to iCloud storage would be excellent. If they let people, I know people who need a higher than 2 terabytes for $10 a month storage plan. The thing that they introduced last year was if you have a 200 or one or
what is that? Was it a couple of years. Oh, you mean him skip your video?
200 or 2 terabyte plan.
Yeah.
Then you can do HomeKit secure video. 200 supports one camera. 2 terabytes supports 5. You cannot go over. And as we'll discuss in a little bit, I can easily go over. So those are limitations that people want to see changed. But man, it's been some. I saw. I think his name is Spencer Daly, who's a tech meme editor, and he tweeted out like the historical coverage of iCloud storage as featured on Tech Meme, and it was so old, like 2012 stuff, you know. It's like there's not been a change in a long, long time.
Yeah, for sure. Maybe they're waiting for the media bundle stuff so they can kind of roll that together, so you could get like they can do like bigger iCloud plan changes alongside, you know, bundling Apple Music and TV and stuff with a bigger iCloud plan potentially. But I even for my 2 terabyte plan, which I'm currently on, and I only use about 300 gigs of it, I just want iOS, watchOS, macOS to add more features that actually take advantage of the storage. Like iCloud Time Machine for the Mac is like an obvious thing they could do, where you get like a, instead of needing to use you know, Backblaze or that kind of stuff, if I could just use a big block of my 2 terabytes of storage to actually back up my Mac 1-to-1 and just have like a 1-to-1 backup on iCloud, I'd be over the moon with that. Right now I'm like, you know, I'm paying for 2 terabytes but only using like a quarter of it, and that's including with family members on the same thing as well. And it's like, just give me more stuff that I can actually use this storage for. Like, I want to do more with it. Just let me do it, if you know what I mean. We are sponsored this week by Bitrise. If you're an app developer, Bitrise offers iOS continuous integration and delivery that lets you build better applications faster. Bitrise includes a variety of iPhone and iPad specific development solutions. You can do automatic code signing, support for the latest Xcode versions, virtual machines, and so much more. Bitrise offers more than 300 different integrations that you can easily connect the processes and services that you use in your mobile development workflows. Setup is a breeze and maintenance is drastically reduced because it all runs in the cloud, saving you both time and money. There's also out-of-the-box support for the major cross-platform frameworks used to create iOS apps and automatic iOS workflow configuration. Automate your tests for high-quality apps. Bitrise makes it super simple. And for continuous deployment, Bitrise saves you time by even automating releases. You don't have to worry about App Store Connect and, you know, that's a terrible web app. You can just automatically send your App Store signed applications to the App Store through Bitrise, deploy to third parties, and deploy for testing. And security is a priority. You can sit back and relax knowing your data is safe. And Bitrise is already used by the world's most productive mobile teams. So why not add it to your own development workflow? Sign up for free at bitrise.io and learn more at the link in the show notes. Our thanks to Bitrise for supporting Happy Hour.
All right, Mayo, something else new this week is the 13-inch MacBook Pro with Magic Keyboard. And this was, this is a mixed bag here. It depends on your perspective. It's the same design as the 13-inch MacBook Pro with butterfly keyboard, except it has the new inverted T arrow keys. The escape key is next to the touch bar. The touch ID sensor is separated. And most importantly, it's not the butterfly keyboard. It's the Magic Keyboard that's more reliable, arguably a better experience. But they didn't do the change to 14 inches like they did with the 16 inch. And with the 16 inch, we were kind of like, that's it, you know? And this was like less than that. On the other hand, this machine, you know, like if I think back to myself in 2008, 2009, I would have loved this machine over the one that it replaced, you know, even the base model, because, you know, the stigma with butterfly keyboard. Mine didn't have that problem in 2009. This new one doesn't have it now. So it's a good replacement compared to the other one. There's just more to it than that.
Or not very much to it than that, if you see what I mean.
Yeah, it depends.
Like the 16-inch, we were hoping we'd get some like radical new design, kind of like iPhone 10, like, you know, we're super slim bezels and it'd be really sleek and really futuristic, right? Mm-hmm. But that didn't happen.
No.
It was basically the 15-inch body with slightly slimmer bezels to support the 16-inch display, and obviously you get the Magic Keyboard stuff. But that laptop also got features like the studio quality microphones, or what they call studio quality microphones. It got the you know, the super wide speaker system where they do the extra speakers for like pretty impressive sound.
It's good
coming out of a laptop. And then 6 months goes by and they're ready to refresh the 13-inch, and they don't make the screen any bigger. And they don't even do features like the improved microphones or the speakers. And on the low-end version, on the low-end configs, they didn't change the processors either. It's still the same 8th gen Intel processors on the 1299 and the one above that, the 1499. You have to go up to 1799 to actually get new processors, which is the new 10th gen ones, which feels a bit punitive. Like, see, I don't know, it just seems like the base models, apart from the keyboard, are basically unchanged. Like, they did double base storage on the SSD, so it used to start at 128 and now it starts at 256. So that's an improvement for sure. They let you spec up to 4 terabytes of RAM, but obviously you have to pay for that. You have to pay, you know, up extra for that stuff on the build order configs. If you do want a performance boost over what you got last May, you have to pay $17.99 minimum, right, for the first version of the 10th gen Intel processor, and then obviously it goes up from there. The biggest news is obviously the keyboard change. And I will say, when they started doing this transition last year, obviously we knew, like Quo had reported it, everyone was reporting it, that over the course of 2020, we would see all of the laptops change from butterfly back to scissors key mechanisms. I am impressed, surprised that it has actually happened before the middle of the year, right? Like, when it started with the 16-inch MacBook Pro last year, I was, you know, at that time, it still seemed like maybe the MacBook Air wouldn't get refreshed until the fall. You might see the MacBook Pro update come in June, right? And so, you know, they're on an accelerated timeline there. Thankfully, after 5 years of disaster with the Butterfly keyboards, we're now off. There are no Apple sells no Butterfly keyboard machines anymore as of May the 7th, right? Mm-hmm. Like, they don't sell them on the iPad. So, they don't sell them.
Quo had the report before that about the change to the non-butterfly to scissor switches,
yes.
Before the 16-inch came about, and so he yes. had that, and he had a timeline for it too, and it included MacBook Pro, MacBook Air, and a full transition there for MacBooks. So he got that right. He had a report about a 14.1-inch MacBook Pro joining the lineup after the 16-inch redesign. And that included a new iMac Pro. And I think that was Q4 of this year. So he didn't say, and this was in March. This was March the 3rd. So it was not that long ago. So he didn't say, there's two separate ports. And he didn't say, like, the Magic Keyboard will come to a 13-inch, you know, 14-inch version. It'll all be one thing together. He just said, they'll, you know, separately, there'll be a Magic Keyboard to the lineup. And separately, there'll be a 14.1-inch MacBook Pro in the lineup. And this is like the in-between state of all that, even timing-wise, because he's saying in Q4 we see the 14.1-inch, and this is Q2, and we have the 13-inch with Magic Keyboard.
Well, we could see a 14-inch in Q4, though.
Yeah, exactly. That's right. What I'm saying is, like,
yeah.
this does not roll out the 14-inch, because there was, like, that was just like a feature request, basically. It was like, if you look at the 16-inch, you want the same thing for the 13-inch to change the design, make a bigger screen, you know, a little bit, and have overall the body be very similar. And it wasn't until Quo had the report on March 3rd that it went from like a desire to a rumor, you know.
Sure, yeah. And there's been other rumors and stuff from DigiTimes and other sources as well saying mm-hmm. that the 14.1-inch is development. I think people just kind of ran with that and just assumed it would be the 13.3-inch sure. with a bigger screen.
Yeah.
And clearly that hasn't happened.
And so. something else I'll flag here too is that John Prosser on Twitter, who nailed the release date for the iPhone SE, you know, we had some good details on what the name would be and the storage and the colors and the cases. He had the release date, you know, down far in advance. On the morning of this release date, he learned and shared on Twitter that there would be this new MacBook Pro. And that was the first, you know, sighting we saw of that. And
yeah, there were some like vague rumblings that it was coming in May sometime.
Yeah. Right?
But not literally like on a Monday.
And yeah, he had it was. a day of release, you know, in advance. So that was good. So just to give him credit. And then here comes the thing, and it is what it is. Yeah,
like, it's kind of disappointing, right, that there wasn't a bigger update plan, because this time last year, the 13-inch didn't get a huge update either. So it's kind of like carrying on that line of, like, and the 13-inch MacBook Pro is way more popular in terms of sales than the 16-inch just because it's way cheaper, right? Like, yeah. More people buy it. Like, people are buying either the Air, which is their most popular laptop, or they're buying the 13-inch Pro. The 16-inch Pro, you know, is a really nice machine, but it's also very expensive. And so most people don't buy that
one. And big and heavier. Yeah.
And big and heavy, right, exactly. And most people in the world, you know, money, not an object at all, would pick the 13-inch form factor anyway just because it's smaller and more compact and portable. And so the 13-inch MacBook Pro is the MacBook Pro experience for most people. Mm-hmm. And the current one is kind of like, well, I guess it's the same as the year before, and I guess it's the same as the year before that, except that now the keyboard isn't broken, right? Like, if Apple hadn't messed up the keyboard, if they hadn't made the mistake, this update would be almost like inconsequential, right? Like, it's pretty small change for the situation. Obviously, it seems like they're going to have a bigger redesign coming later in the year with this 14.1-inch model, which presumably will not replace the 13.3-inch one. It will kind of like slot in between somewhere.
Well, didn't they have a 15-inch update in the same year as the 16, and the 16 replaced the 15?
Yeah. So this time last year, they updated the 15-inch with the third generation Butterfly keyboard with new materials. Remember?
So this could be a 6-month-old laptop on the market and then get replaced. But probably not for that low price end, because with the 16-inch, it was high end and it just replaced it at the high price point. At this point, you know, maybe you see the higher end version get replaced, and that'd be kind of weird.
Yeah, because the higher end ones, the ones they made the most investment in, right, with the 10th gen processors. Yeah. That's why it's confusing, because it feels like if they do have the 14.1-inch model coming in as a separate option, it's going to jam up the cleanness of the line again. Like, and it feels like we just got to a point of having a pretty nice lineup of distinction between Air Pro 16 inch, right?
Yeah, and there's still, so still confusion about or now with this release about MacBook Air or MacBook Pro when the prices are so similar. And the difference, I mean, the decision making is just like, you know, do you want the portability or do you want an improved screen? Do you want a better screen, a brighter and higher quality screen? So it's you know, even power wise, it's like, you know, debatable. But
okay, if the mission objective was to just get rid of the Battlefly keyboard as quickly as possible,
yeah,
this could just be a 6 month machine.
Yeah, yeah.
In the fall, it goes away, and you have the same specs as what's available now, but you have it in a much more modern chassis with a slightly bigger screen.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah.
I can see that. Yeah, I can see that. I hadn't thought so much about that until just now, you know, now today. But that makes sense.
And, yeah, and they can keep the low-end model around for education and, you know, hit the price points at the low end and stuff.
Yeah. It would be weird to say MacBook Pro 13-inch, MacBook Pro 14-inch, MacBook Pro 16-inch without kind of putting the 13-inch, you know, in this other category that you don't see automatically. Because then it'd be so clean. 13-inch MacBook. I mean, we talked about this before, how clean it would be. 13-inch MacBook Air, 14-inch MacBook Pro, 16-inch MacBook Pro. And then there wouldn't be that even like, we're kind of in this area now where you can get a MacBook Pro for less money with a better display than a MacBook Air, similar performance. And so maybe that's
The performance on the Pro will be better, even on the low-end models, just because of cooling compared to the Air, right? So the Air does have a fan in it, but it's smaller and the heat profile is way different, whereas the MacBook Pro is that, you know, that extra bit of thickness and the double fan design,
so you can have it can cool, higher performance,
it can cool
for
the
longer.
Processor for much longer, and the long-term performance of the chip is way better sustained than the Air can achieve.
So it's right, the name Air and Pro. I like that.
I guess if I was somebody who was like waiting out for a 13-inch redesign, obviously you're going to be disappointed, right? Because it's a minor spec bump with a fixed keyboard. That's basically what it boils down to, right? And some people have said, oh, you've got like the old one on the low end, and then from 1799, you've got like a new MacBook Pro. They're just all the same. They're just like, one's actually got spec bumps and one hasn't, but they didn't change the prices. Like the 16 inch, although it was kind of like a smaller redesign than we were anticipating, because they didn't change the prices, it felt like a win.
Because,
you know, the screen got bigger, they added in some extra features, and it kind of felt, okay, they haven't actually made it more expensive. Whereas here, they haven't changed the prices, but they haven't really given you much more for your money. So it's kind of like a, you know, whatever update. We've got the Butterfly keyboard out of the lineup. That's got to be a positive, right? And then now they can rebuild from here on a lineup of laptops that everyone can't complain about.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And reviews came out on Thursday for the new 13-inch MacBook Pro. So if you really are in the market for this, you can kind of see what people are saying about it. And we've got a review roundup on 9to5 Mac. And just to like visualize the comparisons between 13-inch computers. There's some charting there as well. So I'm glad I'm not in the market for this, because I would be impatient and be like, where's the 14 inch, you know? But,
maybe when the 14 inch does come, it has mini LED potentially, because obviously there's concurrent rumors about mini LED displays coming to all of Apple's products.
That's when I'll be annoyed at my 16 inch. Right now, I'm feeling good. So,
I mean, they'll probably do a 16 inch with mini LED as well, right? So you can just upgrade to that.
I don't want to upgrade.
Yeah, we know that plays.
Although I will say, I bought 1 terabyte this time, because that was an upgrade from 256 on the other MacBook that I had, and then I had the Mac Pro with 1 terabyte. But I just thought, I just do 1 terabyte; it's fine. And I can live on 1 terabyte now. But I, for being like the only computer, I'm interested in 2 terabyte. But I vow here not to replace that 16 inch anytime soon, because what I would buy next is like that 23-inch rumored iMac, and then have that be the more storage, you know, and always on kind of.
Yeah, and the iMac update continues to hang over us as something that we think's coming this year at some point, but we don't really know when.
That's right.
We are also sponsored this week by Pillow. Getting a good night's sleep is underrated, but with a little help, it can be life-changing. Pillow is an all-in-one sleep tracking solution to help you be more aware of your sleep patterns and discover what might be affecting your sleep quality. If you have an Apple Watch, tracking your sleep is as easy as wearing it to bed using the Pillow app. Pillow will track and analyze your sleep automatically. One of Pillow's most loved features is the ability to get a detailed heart rate diagram of every sleep session that you have. You can compare your sleep quality with your weight, steps, caffeine consumption, and many other health metrics to discover how they might be affecting how you sleep. And you can enable recording, and Pillow will save the sounds that you make during sleep, from sleep talking to sleep apnea, snoring, or just random unexpected noises in the night that might be affecting your sleep. You can use recording to find out what's going on, and a lot of users have been surprised by the results. And Pillow is very privacy-minded. All of your sleep and audio data is encrypted and stored on your device. And when you're using iCloud to sync, it's using end-to-end encryption. Pillow doesn't have user accounts, so you can use it anonymously, and it doesn't collect or send your personal data anywhere else. Naps boost your focus, creativity, and overall well-being. And if you're working from home, you can take naps right now using Pillow's power nap modes. And Pillow uses the watchOS 6 extended runtime API for extreme battery efficiency. So if you're using Pillow as an alarm, you can wake up using your iPhone, Apple Watch, or iPad. And it doesn't use excess battery life. Pillow is available on the App Store for iPhone, Apple Watch, and iPad. Discover all of Pillow's features at naybox.com/pillow. That's naybox.com/pillow. Sleep well and stay safe. Our thanks to Pillow for their support of Happy Hour.
All right, I want to talk about HomeKit. And this is a precursor to a story I've got coming in May sometime. Probably the end of May. And let me look at my notebook here because I've got so many notes. But it's basically like, we mentioned in October when I purchased a home and moved to a house where I can make these permanent changes that I've got. I know that I want to change in a year's time when I, move again. And it takes, it's taken me 6 months plus to make many of these changes, even though I've had the stuff ready to go. It's just time and effort. And
right now you've got a lot of time on your hands.
Yeah. I've been calling this like safer at home kit or like home kit improvements in quarantine, stuff like that. But there's a number of things that have changed that have gone just, beyond Philips Hue lights and Lutron switches and, smart plugs. So I just want to go through a few things that'll have highlighted in the story later this month. A big thing will be I've gotten way more into automation, and it's a benefit of having a permanent place to live, and you can kind of like look at the patterns of behavior and people and where they are and when they're here and there, and have a good system there. But I'll have that detailed in the story. It's too complex for audio, I think. But something that's new this year that I've tried is the Abode home security system. And that's a do-it-yourself home security system where you buy just the pieces that you need, and then you can pay to have a subscription for having features like cellular supported, so that if your power is out, the security system still works, or the ability to call 911 or emergency services where you live. And all I do so far is I just have the main thing, which is also a HomeKit camera, and so it's cool for that. And then it works. It's like the main hub for the other sensors, like a door sensor. That's all I use for it right now. Is I've got the hub, which is a camera, and I've got the door sensor, which just tells you if your door is open or closed. And you can buy those on their own. But I've liked it. And Kobe has a new thing called Haven that's like the same exact concept, just a different competitor. I priced it out, and I think like getting started is like around $200 for like the hub and a couple of sensors. I priced it out and to complete the system, which I intend to do, to have a window sensor on every window and a door sensor on every door, and to have like a yard sign that's solar powered and says like protected by Abode. It'd be about $350 or so. So
it's not too bad.
It's not too bad. Yeah. And that's like a single cost where it's also just cool for HomeKit, like just to have.
And just to be clear, that's an officially supported HomeKit product, right? It's not like a third party thing that integrates and
exactly
unofficially.
Exactly. Like it's in the home app, and all the sensors would be in the home app. And you can do things like you can have fun with automation. Like if a door opens after hours, then turn on the light outside and that kind of thing. And it's also kind of cool, like just seeing how many times a day throughout the day the door is open and closed and everything. So, and again, you can get those sensors for windows and doors on your own, but, to have it as part of a security system is kind of cool. So I intend to take the first part of it and complete the investment for, and have the whole system done. So that's pretty cool. I've also got a the Natatmo weather station. We both have one of these, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And part of that is the indoor sensor. And what I've obsessed over with the indoor sensor is carbon dioxide levels, so CO2.
The parts per million number.
Yeah. So the CO2, and my number has been, and it's not carbon monoxide, so it isn't like, you know, having your car in the garage or your oven, gas oven left on. But you can still get headaches at a high level, and so it's not recommended to have higher levels. And since I've had this thing, it's been super high, like in the 2200s parts per millions, and at the high end, and like as low as 1500 parts per million. So, you know, it's put me down the whole research thing of like, what does this mean? How do I affect it? You know, and I kind of wish that it'd be like
you asked me what do I get?
Yeah,
and I'm like between like 600 and 1000 basically.
That's yeah. Yeah. So I wanted that, you know, because it shows you also like in the app for Natatmo, is it good, moderate, or bad? And mine's always been moderate. I've never had good before. So, and my wife got in on this. She thought I was obsessing over it. And so she's like, I'm going to shut you up by, you know, doing what I can to figure this out myself. So we had, and HomeKit will only give you an alert if it's at a high enough level. Even if it's like moderate, it takes a high enough level for it to give you an alert. But we've often seen triggers of like the CO2 alarm is alerted in the Home app and you get an alert for that. So it's like, what can we do to change that? So what we did was we opened up every window overnight. And I also have an air purifier that I purchased just to have, you know, a filter the room too. But air quality was not a problem. It was just the CO2 level. And just having the windows open overnight, it was that it went down to 400 from 2200. So, and you can look at the chart in the Natatmo app and see like over time, like where is the level? And it had never been that low. So it's like, okay, fresh air, you know, and we're thinking about introducing new plants. Like we've got a lot of fake plants that we can't kill just for, you know, the look. But we're thinking about getting plants too to kind of help out and control that. But it's like, you know, never imagined in 2014 that HomeKit would be used to improve the CO2 levels on my house, but you know, here we are.
It's funny you mentioned about looking in and out for the graphs. That's what something I wish they put in the actual Home app.
Me like, too.
You don't get any history whatsoever. It's just current values.
That's right. Yeah.
So, and you always have to rely on like the third party proprietary apps to get the history stuff.
Yeah.
And so it'd be nice if you could just like tap on the current information. It shows you, you know, the last readings from the last day or whatever, and it you could just move on from there.
But yeah,
that doesn't happen.
Something else I thought about was, you know how the health app used to be so sparse, but they've added in like, what does this value mean? And like, here is the link to source to learn more about that. You don't get that with like CO2 levels.
It just says here's a number.
Yeah,
have fun.
Go research it. Yeah. So I've got that and I've had fun, like kind of like mastering that number down. And then we closed the windows the next day and it went back up, you know, a little bit, but not as much. So, it's just now we have that as a routine of like open windows. Get the one link carbon monoxide in smoke detector. You know, I had one of these a few years ago and just moving around, I didn't keep it installed between places, but now I got a version that's battery operated instead of wired. And the luxury there is you can put it anywhere with a little installation. It was so easy because I've never had a battery version. I only had wired. And it was just like 10 minutes and I was done. And so we got to add this to the kitchen area, which is like our house is like cut in half, like bedrooms and then like living room, kitchen, laundry, et cetera. So this is like now in that side of the house. And that's neat. And it was so easy to do, you know. And the cool thing there is like, you know, if you just have one of these things and, you know – you never have a fire or carbon monoxide, you know, leak or excessive level, then what's the value there? But the cool thing that I've done in the past and then have set up this time is if smoke's detected after sunset, turn on all the lights in the home so that, you know, and unlock the doors. And that's the benefit of having like HomeKit throughout is everyone can see without being like, you know, in the dark. And you don't have to worry about the door being locked, but as it would be at night, it's unlocked, so you just go out. So, you know, hopefully I never have to use that automation, but it's kind of a cool thing to build there. They're doing things in HomeKit lately where like a HomeKit TV, for example, it will suggest using that as like when you leave home or say goodnight to turn it off.
Little suggested scenes.
Yeah, they need to do that for automations too, because like that's the big use of a HomeKit smoke detector, carbon monoxide detector is that automation for me. And that was true, you know, a few years ago. It's true to this day. So that's one link. Yale AssureLock SL with IM1 network module. That is my
front- is a catchy name.
Yeah, that is my front door lock. And I requested to review this thing. It'll be in the story at the end of the month. But the thing I liked about it is it's a keyless lock. So it's got a keypad on the outside, and the inside is just the turn switch. And they've got a version with keys as well. But I find that I've got a very good experience with the smart lock system. And, you know, a key is good to have as a backup, but I'm obsessed with having as few things as possible on my keychain. Like right now, I'm literally down to just my car key, you know, and some cars, you don't need that even. But I don't carry a house key. And,
that is pretty cool.
I've not had an issue with that. If the main battery dies in the system, you've got a 9-volt backup battery that only runs when the double A's die. And you've got the keypad. So you would need to forget the passcode to get locked out. The passcode is the key. And it just looks so sharp to me to not have a key, not to carry a key. It's neat. And, like, you know, keys are a security. Like, you know, you the risk there is that you forget your passcode or something, or it bugs out and you can't get in your home. But, like, keys are also a security hazard because, you know, locksmiths can make keys, you know, and you can... You can defeat key locks. So I really like it. It comes in polished brass, which is like this gold color. That's what I've got. Oil rubbed bronze is like the closest thing to black, and then satin nickel is like a silver.
So it runs on internal batteries. So you put in like AA batteries into it.
Yeah, and I've had this thing for months now. I haven't changed the batteries yet.
And then it's good.
The backup is the 9-volt that it only uses if the main batteries die.
Is it a pain to replace the batteries? Do you have to, like, unscrew something?
Nope, yeah. Nope. Just pop a door off inside on the lock inside. And
oh, you do it on the inside? Okay, that makes sense. Yeah.
And whenever I rented, I loved the August locks because you could cut the same key on the outside, and on the inside you changed your deadbolt, you know, basically.
Yeah.
And with this, to change the hardware outside as well, but not being a renter anymore doesn't matter. So it's another benefit of the move. And on the bottom, we replaced the bottom door handle from being one with a key as well to being just like a lever style handle. It's just a keyless black lever style handle. So there's no key to be had on the front door, and I really like that a lot. Now the big thing here is I had to rehang my door, and this was a problem when I rented. Certain locks would report in HomeKit that they were jammed when they would work okay in their own apps. And it was that HomeKit had a certain sensitivity to, I guess, the speed of locking it. And if it was too slow, it would say jammed. And then when it's jammed, it's not locked or unlocked, it's jammed. And it can still toggle the behavior, but it's not happy with doing that.
Yeah.
So that
it's like an error state. Yeah.
Exactly. And you can't say, like, is the door locked or unlocked? You know, it's jammed, and it's going to be open or closed. Doesn't matter. It's jammed. The thing with this is I couldn't rehang a door before, like ask maintenance to do it maybe or something, but this time it was my own house. So we took the door off. We rehung the door. Cause over time the door, like it's probably a 20-year-old door, and every time, like, it just kind of, like, the top is what gives way first. So the top was offset, changed that. We changed a little bit about where the lock insert is, just moved it forward a little bit, and now it works perfect. And I'm so happy. Like, I left it the bad way for a while, and my brother is here, and he was like, it's kind of pointless to have a smart lock they can't use. like, yeah, I guess you're right. So we fixed it. But that's the key system. I'm awaiting arrival of a couple of HomeKit doorbells, and this is awesome. I checked in with the Tatmo, and they've got like the best looking one that we've reported on so far, but it's still not out yet. It's still in development, and it hasn't, you know.
The mythical HomeKit doorbell.
Yeah.
For whatever reason, just take years to come to market.
Yeah, and a health pandemic just hasn't sped up the process for some reason. So, you know, there you go. But you've got the Robin telecom whatever
it's called.
And the
thing with the Robin ones is they were like the first ones to market with a HomeKit doorbell.
Mm-hmm.
But they're very clearly aimed at like businesses, right? Because it's like a business style.
It's so
like,
industrial looking.
Yeah, it's huge. Like, it's like almost as tall as my head, just like this panel.
Yeah.
And it, you know, and it is kind of cool because you get your little house address etched into it, so it looks kind of slick. But it's just so big, we haven't been able to use it because where our little doorbell fits on the house, you know, it's one like the August doorbells, which are like that big, right? Just really skinny. And this thing is like a tank, and it's so big, and you have to like mount it in this box, and you have to do all this stuff with it. And so it's just kind of like sat in my office for years.
Doesn't yours have 9 to 5 Mac etched into it too?
Yeah, it did have 9 to 5 Mac etched into it. I actually paid to get it re-etched.
Oh, so, good. Cool. Nice.
So now I have a still not one that I haven't used, but at least it has my actual home address written on it.
That's classic.
Well, and it is kind of cool. But and then the other problem with it, in addition to it being big, is it's also incredibly expensive because they're clearly aiming at like business prices. So the Robin one that I did get it for free. I got it for review. I would never bought it for myself.
Right.
It was, at least when I bought, at the time when I got it, it was 750 euros.
Okay.
So basically a grand, right? Like $1. And now they've come out with a smaller one?
There's the compact one, which I requested, and I think it will arrive before the next episode. And it's perfect for the back door. Because it still looks industrial. I mean, it's much smaller, but it still has this, like, the panel on it, the screen. Like, you don't really need a screen, but it's got one. And it just looks like something old mainframe, like weird. So we'll put that in the back door. But it's HomeKit, and I think it's the one you have.
Secure Video as well, yeah.
Yeah, the one you have is, they don't really specify for the compact one, but I imagine it is. But again, the price thing is what's incredible there. It's in US dollars, it's $540. So that's kind of a
they're so expensive.
Tough sell.
It's so weird that like Apple approved this one company that was so ahead of the market, but it was just like the one that's the most anti-consumer option, if you know what I mean. Like,
yeah.
It's pretty weird.
What is the application for a HomeKit doorbell on like an apartment building? And it's like the building's doorbell, you know, it's.
Yeah, because that's what it looks like. It looks like a doorbell for an apartment,
yeah,
but it's only
office.
Got one button on it. So it's not as useless as an apartment building button because it can only do one thing.
Yeah, you can only chime the doorman. And
why
would they use HomeKit? So
it's almost like they took, because Robin sell the apartment building doorbells, right, which have multiple buttons on them. So I think they basically just took their chassis that they already made and just stripped it down to make it HomeKit compatible to get a HomeKit smart doorbell out the door.
And they were first.
And they were first, and they did achieve seemingly what no other company managed to do.
Still the only.
Yeah. So you've got to give them some credit, but it's just a shame that the product they come out with doesn't really fit any like normal person's needs.
They were first and second in this case. The other one that I've requested, and I think will come this month in time for this story, is from the model is called Yobi YOBI B3, and it comes in one color, which is like a combination of black and gold. Fortunately for me, it will match my lock. Because it's also that kind of gold color, although it's a little bit like more like rose gold than like bronzy. But it's got a great price, and it's available for pre-order. And I've not seen much press for this thing, which is surprising. But it was announced at the beginning of this year or so, $199, so $200.
That's good.
That's better than a lot of like Ring doorbells.
Yeah,
you know. So that's really cool, and it's HomeKit. I don't think it's going to be HomeKit Secure Video yet, but maybe, you know, maybe in the future. But that's going to be really cool because right now my solution for the front and back door is to have in the front door, I have a Logi Circle 2 HomeKit camera pointing outside. And so I get the temperature readings and everything from the inside that I don't really need because it's not accurate to the outside, but I at least get the outside view. And I love that with HomeKit Secure Video because then you can see back, like if someone came to your door and left, like you can, it's recorded. And so I'll replace that with the doorbell when it arrives. The back door, I'll do the Robin. The solution to my back door now isn't a Circle 2, but outside. It's like on the light fixture outside. And it's like somebody could just come in and plug it and take it if they wanted to. But they haven't yet. But that'll be cool to have it integrated with the doorbell there too. So I'm looking forward to that. I've got seven cameras right now, seven HomeKit cameras. I think most of which I've purchased, which are Logi Circle 2s because I just like them that much after the first review unit. And then I've got a review unit of the baby cam, but I took the ears off of that. That's the Arlo. And then I've got the D-Link. No, I bought the D-Link too. The D-Link Omni HD because it was the
first. That was the original, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was the first HomeKit video camera at all. And it's probably also the worst. So, you know, yeah. But yeah.
Yeah, the Logitech circles are pretty good.
Yeah, yeah. So I bought many of those. I'm up 7. But if the HomeKit doorbells arrive as expected, you know, for the review, then I'll be at 9. And right now I think I'm at 4 for HomeKit secure video. You can only do 5. So I will prioritize the doorbells because that's the idea. And then have to take off some indoor ones from HomeKit secure video unless Apple changes the limits, you know, next month. I'll go through a few more things here. And this will all be in the story, but, this has been fun. I mentioned being in the attic for some time this week. My brother's here and he's so crafty and he's been like moving where, outlets are for power around the house for me. And that's been neat because I've got a TV mounted in the office and it's not on the wall where the power outlets are. So it was like always like running a cord down and beyond. And now it's mounted. There's a power outlet behind the TV now. So there's like no cord showing and that's so cool. And so since I found out he was that capable, I was like, well, can we also get like a wire in the office that's internet directly? So we've got that now.
You got wide Ethernet.
Yeah. At first we were doing coax and through the ceiling and we moved it from the bedroom to the office so that there was coax. And then I had a rack over here for all of the networking equipment. And that's where like the router and the modem and the bridge for all the HomeKit stuff was. And it was like a whole, you know, 3-shelf rack dedicated to that. Then we realized that the coax cord that we brought in was blank on the other end. And it's like, oh no. So what we did was we rerouted the one that went to the bedroom, which is like the main one from outside. And we put that down. We put it in the attic. And now the attic coax goes to the modem and the router and a bridge an Ethernet bridge basically. And then to all the different bridges and stuff and the Synology and everything. And then I already had a 50-foot Ethernet cable that I ran from the bedroom to the office for a video. And so now that's what comes down to the ceiling and to the office. So it's
really a bit cleaner.
Yeah. And while I was a few days after doing that change, and it's kind of neat having all the networking in the office anyway, because it's like, or in the attic anyway, because it's like, you know, you go up there, the light's on up there and, now I've got this whole shelf for other things, like, you know, putting chargers and drones and stuff like that. So that's really neat. And then also having it's a one-story home, but having the router in the attic, I can have it like central to the house. And that's like the optimal place for putting that, you know, and then having all the other mesh stations, you know, throughout the house. Mm-hmm. But that's where you want to go is like top down, not, you know, bottom up and beyond. So that's really neat. I took time to change out from the Linksys system that has Wi-Fi 6 to the one that does not. It's only AC. And the idea there is that whenever Linksys releases their HomeKit router support, which is not a big deal at all, I can at least verify that the update's out and works. So there's that.
And you probably don't have many Wi-Fi 6 devices, right? Apart from the iPhone.
It's just the iPhone. Yeah. And to have the benefit of mesh, I've got all the other Linksys FLOP stations and they're not Wi-Fi 6. So sure. I've got to be on the one in the attic, not the one in the room you're in. So yeah, that's something. And it's really cool. Like I've also put a Philips Hue, or not Philips, well, just Philips like motion sensor. And so I get motion in the attic, which can turn on the light in the attic. So you go up there, light comes on. You're not there. It turns off after a set period of time. I can also get the temperature in the attic and the light levels in the attic. So I was sweating up there the other day. And so I was wondering, like, how hot is it there compared to downstairs? And I looked earlier and it was like 86 compared to 74. So I was like, okay, there's definitely a difference without AC up there. But, you know, I hope the networking stuff survives. It's no worse than like a garage or a basement, I think. I think that's mostly it.
So one thing that stuff. I feel like you haven't mentioned, but it's kind of like the forbidden fruit, is shades, right? Light shades.
Yeah, and we've replaced all the blinds in the house with better blinds, but
they're not HomeKit, right?
They're not HomeKit, and that was kind of a disappointment because like the cheapest thing you can do is IKEA. Between $129 and $189, you can have different sizes of shades, but there's only one color so far, and it's like this gray color, which is perfect for my office, but like my wife would not sign off on it for anything else but the office.
Yeah.
So there's that. or you could go with like the Serena Lutron route, but then it's like, man, like 800 minimum per window.
Yeah, yeah. It's just prohibitively expensive.
Yeah, and we've got like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, like tons of windows in the home, so that wouldn't be possible. So then I've tried to go the IKEA route for the office, and stores are closed. You can't walk in and buy stuff anyway, but there's not one near me. But I looked at ordering just one fit for my window, and just to have that, and it's under $200 for both the bridge and the shade. And maybe I'll have it in June.
Okay, it's just on order.
Yeah, I did order it. Right now, I've got nothing in the office window, but it'll be cool to say good night and lower that, or good morning, raise that, because I'm in here a lot anyway. So I'm gonna try it out. But
yeah, because I feel like from like the sci-fi angle, right? It's always like lights and blinds. It's always the stuff that people go to, right? Because that's the stuff that also has some of the highest utility, right? Like, who wants to go over to the light switch? Who wants to go over there and manually to put the blinds down?
And to say one thing and control all of it is just really cool.
Yeah, exactly. And lights are comparatively super simple to actually get changed, right? Because you can, unscrew a light bulb with the Hue stuff, or you can get the switches changed at the wall with Cassetta or Lutron or similar stuff. And it's really cheap. Like, well, okay, it's not really cheap, but it's within normal price ranges, right? And then you look at shades and everything's so much more expensive. It's like,
what's so sophisticated about shades? Like, it's a motor.
Yeah. And some
fabric.
I don't know.
And the fabric is what gets you, I think, is that like because it's viewed as high end to have remote shades, then the fabric is even more high end to somebody, just not us. And that's where you get into like $800 per window. But once you've got the IKEA stuff, hopefully they do more colors in the future than just like this dull gray color, because who wants that? It fits this office, but not much else. Because they are who is nailing it. But I had to use my mom's address in Alabama, not my home address, for shipping, because I think it's like a per store inventory based on where you are. So people would tell me on Twitter, let me know if you need help. That was awesome, because they'd say like, I'll order these and then send them to you. Because they just, IKEA's website so bad too. Like, you would add them to your cart, they'd say available, and they were to some people somewhere. But once you get to my address, they'd say neither were available, or the bridge was available, but not the shades. And then I tried my mom's address, and it was like, okay, they can actually sell me these to my mom's address, and I'll just like have her mail them to me. So sometime in June, they say, maybe. I don't know. We'll see.
Okay, so maybe.
Yeah. Something I didn't mention, a couple of things is one is just the joy in lighting. And I've done this before, but like my porch lights, there's two lights. There's one on either side of the door for the porch. And I have those come on at sunset and then go to 30% around 9 p.m. and then turn off at midnight and then turn on in the morning when my kid would go to school ordinarily, and then turn back off, at a certain time. And that's neat. But having something that's really neat in HomeKit that's always been there is grouping. And so having two lights viewed as one thing to control. So it's porch lights, but it's two bulbs grouped together. In the living room, we have one lamp that's three bulbs, two on top, one on bottom. And I've got that as one device. And because who wants to control those separately?
Yeah, exactly.
And then we've got on either side of the one of the couches, we've got just table lamps. And that's more like you could say you want to control each one of those separately, but for convenience I've got them as one lamp and just call them table lamp, so it's plural. And then you can like dial in and just control lamp one or left two, but by default it's easier just to do the two. And something that I had to buy new lamps, because we had ones that we liked the look of, but they were touch lamps, like touch the base and it turns on or off.
Okay.
And that's okay, but then you get the problem of like the lamp being off, and my 2-year-old Rory loved that he could turn them off or on, and so it was uncontrollable. So we had to change the lamps out. I told my wife, I was looking at lamps in the store, and she was like, "Why are you looking at lamps? We have new lamps already." And I was like, "Don't hate me for this, but can't do touch with HomeKit. Like, it's not working." And so she understood. So we got new lamps. Last thing I'll say is about HomeKit specifically is TVs. I've not really gotten the point of HomeKit TVs before, because my experience has been through HomeBridge with LG, because my nice OLED doesn't support HomeKit, and it's a awesome display, so I'm not going to change it. But then, and then I got another LG for a different room that has HomeKit. And it's not really reliable. And it's just like back to, it was actually less reliable than the HomeBridge implementation. Oh no. So I tried that and it was like, still don't really get what it's for. And then we bought TVs for the kids' rooms through the situation that we're in. And so, they were Vizio for price reasons. And their HomeKit implementation is excellent. It works as you'd expect. And I think with the LG, you like need to turn off some settings, like energy settings, and then maybe it's less flaky, but still not great. With Vizio stuff, it's been awesome. Like you can see what you can control is on and off, you know, manually through Siri or the Home app or automations, and you can control inputs. So that's the two key things there. And it's just so neat to see, like, look at the Home app. Is a TV on? Is it off? What input is it on? You know, if it's always on Apple TV, cool, or using, you know, the built-in stuff, then it'll show that too. And you can say,
yeah, like, and you still can't change inputs with Siri, right?
I don't think so. You can do it manually. Yeah. You can do it manually.
You have to go into the Home app, then you have to go into the details, and you have to click on the input button.
I'll follow up on that because it might not be the case, but it's
at least of like, the start of this year, you couldn't do it.
Yeah. You can't do volume, which is a big one, because like with the Fire TV, you can do volume with Echo, with Alexa. So that's a big miss. And I use a Dolby Atmos soundbar from LG, and I can control that from the iPhone with the control center. When I've got that view open, it has like volume toggles there. Or I think I can do like the volume buttons on the phone itself, and that'll change it too from the remote app. But you can't use Siri or the Home app to change that. So there's some opportunity there. But I finally get like what HomeKit TV is meant to be, which is the automation stuff, on off stuff from the iPhone or Siri, and then, you know, input switching. And so now I know that what I'd really like to see next is volume control. You know, that would be great. We'll see how that goes. And then the last thing to mention is just in my office, as I've been doing this, I've been changing some things in my office. And so I've got two displays now. They're both the LG 4K Ultrafine, the 21.5-inch, not the new 24-inch.
So the better ones.
The truly Retina ones. And what got me on this is I had one before that I bought, you know, last year, year before that, and it was like to try out stuff for the iPad, and I ended up liking it so much that, you know, I use it with the Mac now, mostly. And these smaller ones are great when you're coming from a smaller display to these as larger. If you go from like a large display to these, and they're just like tiny and cramped, but now they're like they're bigger than the 16-inch MacBook Pro, so they're great. And the second one I bought specifically to have a portrait orientation display on the Mac. And, you know, I got that kind of craving from seeing the Pro Display XDR in the store when it was like turned portrait. It's like, whoa, this is a whole different experience. I couldn't just live this way, but having the option is awesome. And, you know, the Pro Display XDR, you can like rotate it pretty easily, you know, hold a little thing and rotate it, and the system knows. With this, you've got to tell macOS display settings, like which is which. And it's so annoying because sometimes they get confused and it's like, you know, you got to turn your head to see. And like I did a macOS update and it defaulted to the portrait one. So it was like sideways. So it's not perfect, but I really like it. And, you know, it's neat having like reading a whole article without scrolling is like great for my attention. So it's cool. I've got a project here that I've been talking about with you, which is these displays. You can't daisy chain them and do like one to the other to your computer. Like one, two,
yeah, they don't have Thunderbolt bandwidth in them. They're just USB-C.
Right. And so I've got two cables instead of one, and that's not, you know, it's kind of annoying. And that's what kind of causes the issue where, like, which one's portrait, which one's landscape. It's like, you've got to go, for me, landscape first, then portrait. But we think there's a way, because they're USB-C, to go into like HDMI and get in. They've got an EGP.
There's gonna be a way to figure it out.
Yeah, I'll
so
get
you
there.
Can get back to one port into the Thunderbolt dock, and
I'll get there eventually soon. And I'm also
because the one port lifestyle, not only have one port on your computer, but only have one port to plug in when you sit down. It's so nice.
Yeah, and then I've got these on a VESA mount. This is the first time I've ever done a VESA mount before, and it's like a dual arm thing that was like $30, and so I can move them around and everything, and it's so cool. I'm so happy with that setup. So that's my HomeKit stuff, and look for the story. Nice. End of the month. Yeah,
you are truly making the smart home.
Yeah, you know,
I've always wanted.
I've expected at the end of like October to be done with this, and here we are in May, and I'm like making a lot of progress, but it feels great. So as of like last night, I've got HomeKit lighting in the ceiling. So, which was a process. It was like replacing the light fixture up there to be an LED light that worked with the stuff, and then, you know, as the lights on switch, and it works now. So
we all know that a VPN protects your privacy and your security. But what you can also do is use a VPN to evade geographic content blocks, access movies and TV shows that simply aren't available to you in your country, but are to somewhere else, someone else, somewhere else in the world. Use ExpressVPN to change your location. Not literally, but when you connect to ExpressVPN, you can choose the physical location of the server that you use to browse the web. So you can appear to be from somewhere else to sites like Netflix, Hulu, BBC iPlayer, YouTube. The list just goes on and on. Are you in the US and you want to watch Doctor Who or something like Blackadder? Fire up ExpressVPN, set your location to the United Kingdom, and you can see the same content library as I do when I use Netflix in England. ExpressVPN hides your IP address and lets you control where you want sites to think you're located, and you can choose from almost 100 different countries. There are loads of VPNs out there, but ExpressVPN stands apart as being ridiculously fast. You can stream HD video without any buffering or lag whilst proxying over the ExpressVPN connection. And you can, of course, use ExpressVPN across all of your devices, from iPhone to Android to games consoles, smart TVs, and so much more. Watch what you want on the go, on the big screen, wherever you are. And if you use our special link right now, that's expressvpn.com/happyhour, you can get an extra 3 months of ExpressVPN for free. Support the show, watch what you want, and protect yourself online. Go to expressvpn.com/happyhour to get started.
All right, Mayo, you wrote a story this week called 6 months on. Apple TV Plus features creative original shows, but service remains confusing for newcomers. Why? What's there? What's the reason? I guess it's the half anniversary, but...
It's like... Obviously, you know, we've talked about Apple TV Plus a lot since it came out, but it kind of crept up on us that, wow, it's actually 6 months since November 1st when the service launched, yeah, right?
We've talked about it longer before it came out than we have since it came out. And this
probably.
This is a really good like encapsulation of the state of things so far that historically I think will be neat to look back on.
Yeah. So I kind of ran it up like the... Because, you know, Apple TV Plus has had quite a storied existence because when it came out in November... The critical reaction was pretty negative, right? And so everyone who thought that this was such a failure for Apple original content was had something to fall back on. And even today, when arguably the overall show quality is pretty high, everyone still loves to like mention, but you know, it was a complete flop out of the gate because no of the critics liked it, blah, blah, blah. So I want to do a story that kind of like summarized the path of the service over the first like half of year, especially as we're coming up to the software updates, which may or may not change the equation a little bit. We don't know yet. And because what you have to remember is iOS 14 obviously gets developer previews in June, but when it ships in September, that's only like a month off of when the first free trials actually start expiring,
sure,
right? Because
yeah.
The free trials start November 1st. So if Apple wants to truly capitalize on the service, they want to have, you know, meaningful updates to the apps, the TV app, which we have decried repeatedly over the last few months, and then do it even more so in this article, because what ships in iOS 14 will basically be what's shipping when November 1st rolls around, which is when the first lot of free trials expire. And I personally expect they'll do some different free trial deal, but that'll be the first like big break point for like retention, right? Because people really want to stay on the service. If Apple wants to keep them, they should probably have better apps than they do. And realistically, those need to be in iOS 14, otherwise it's too late. And so I wanted to get this out of the way before any of that stuff happened or didn't happen, just as like, you know, a bit of record, and also to kind of summarize, because a lot of people like tweet me and they're like, I don't understand your problem with the TV, what's wrong with that? So I kind of just like brought together the situation.
And you have a separate Mail blog post diving into the TV app.
I have numerous TV app posts on my blog
that people
over the
read.
Last like 6 months. Yeah. One this week, which again is another issue, which I think is a very good post. You should read it.
Yes.
But this post in general on TV Plus was kind of like the service overall.
Yeah.
And back in November, I think you know, I think I've been fairly consistent with my opinion on the service. I said, obviously, you know, 8 originals isn't enough to sustain a subscription, but it will take some time. They will build up a library, and then they probably have a shot at doing an all-original service only that can actually sustain itself by the end of, like, next year or something. And 6 months on, I still think they're on track for that, right? So when they launched November 1st, they had 8 shows. As of June the 5th, which is the latest they've announced their schedule for, so we're actually waiting for them to announce the next lot of programming for the next couple of months, they will have 27 shows. So basically 30 individual programs. If they carry on at the current rate that they've been doing, by the end of 2021, they will cross 100. And once you get to 100, I feel like you can sustain a service, because a lot of the complaints about Apple TV Plus, which are perfectly valid, is that it doesn't have any back catalogue. There isn't loads of content around, right? But if you can just, like, accept that Apple has enough money so they have enough patience to wait a year, 2 years, 3 years, by the end of 2021, they will have 100 titles on the service. Mm-hmm. And when you're up to 100, I feel like you're up to the level where you've got enough that people can watch something constantly. Because when you get to 100, that's also equivalent to basically, like, one new thing per week.
Sure.
So at the moment, you, like, we went through January and then you released, like, one program, which is clearly, you know, not enough for a service long term. But by the end of 2021, assuming they can keep up the rate of growth that they're doing, they will be able to release, like, either a new season of a show or a new show altogether every single Friday, which at that point, I feel like the service could probably stand on its own and it doesn't need the free trial stuff to back it up with. Because if you look at, like, HBO, you know, they've got thousands of hours of programming, but you know, people aren't watching it all at once, right? They're focusing on core shows. And if you look at Apple Arcade, Apple Arcade has over 100 games. I couldn't name you all the games they've got. Like, it's too many, right? It's more than your headspace. And so it feels like a viable service. And so I think Apple TV Plus is very much headed in that direction where they can be kind of like the new HBO of high-quality programming. And basically what we said in November is true. Like, you know, they're not there yet, but they're on the path. The TV app is basically unchanged since November, so I've had the same problems with it since November. Mm-hmm. Hopefully that changes. I think their approach to, or their reception to content is changing. Like, in general, the you know, out of the gate, their reviews of show, like, critical reviews of shows is pretty negative, to be honest. But I think general audience reaction was much stronger. And as we've rolled into 2020, they've been getting more accolades, and they obviously won the SAG Award for the morning show. And I think in general, people are acclimatizing the idea that, you know, Apple TV Plus is a service that exists. When a show comes out and they say it's exclusive to Apple TV Plus, like in December when that happened with, like, Servant or whatever, everyone's like, I don't even know what Apple TV is. Why are you putting on this? Just put it on Netflix. Blah, blah, blah. And so now people are more accustomed to it because it's just embedded into this, you know, the social culture more that, oh, okay, this is on this service. We can pick it up. And clearly Apple TV Plus is not the biggest streaming service in the world, and it's not going to be, maybe ever, but definitely not for a while. It's, you know, you've got Netflix way ahead, you've got Amazon Prime, you've got Hulu, then you've got Disney Plus, and then somewhere beyond that, you've got Apple TV Plus. But I think and of course Apple doesn't release numbers, but you can just kind of gauge the crowd. For the number of shows that they have, I think they're on the right track and they seem to be building an audience that is strong enough.
Yeah. Read the piece, because it's thorough. Something I love in here that just really captures, like, what the change from the March event before to now is this. Amazing Stories was originally billed as a flagship show. Spielberg was the first famous face on stage at Apple's March services event, but it missed the November 1st launch, debuted in March with half the number of episodes as originally ordered, and the stories were middling at best. And that's, like, that's not the story of Apple TV Plus. That's the story of, like, one show on it.
Yeah.
And it's just, like, such a different, it shows how on one hand, like, the talent, you attach Spielberg to it, and that was, like, their first guest on stage. Mm-hmm. And, you know, same thing for Oprah, I'd say. It's like, that's not what you come to TV Plus for. And that's not, those haven't been the big hits. Like, the Little America stuff was, like, what we heard the most positive about on, like, a single show. And yeah, it wasn't either big name, you know, and so, and there's still stuff from the media event that isn't out yet, right? Like,
right. So they will have the one show that is still, like, missing in action is the Little Voice show, which was the one with J.J. Abrams.
Mm-hmm.
Because they had Sarah Bareilles and J.J. Abrams on stage to preview Little Voice. and that hasn't come out yet, and they don't have a date for it coming out either. That's the last one on that on the March event that wasn't shown. They've caught up with everything but Little Voice. As far as I know, Little Voice filmed at the end of last year, so I think it should be coming out soonish, but they haven't said anything on that yet.
Yeah.
Have you been watching anything on TV Plus recently?
Home. Yeah, I love Home.
The documentary series.
It was made for me. There's a story like that. What's the name? What's the one on Netflix?
The World's Most Extraordinary Homes, I think it's called.
Yeah, I enjoyed the content and half of the hosts. There were two hosts. And then when I showed my wife this show Home, she's like, oh, no, that's the one with all the terrible hosts on it. It's like, no, it's not. And it actually is like a different feel than that. It's more like mini documentaries about each home versus like a reality, you know, a tour with a host.
It focuses more on the people rather than the actual just like building of the house, I think, as well. Like,
mm-hmm. Yeah. And yeah. So I've seen the first episode and then each of the U.S. locations. And that is a show that was made for me. Like I mentioned, the morning show is honest. Like I'm really fascinated by how nice the apartment is, you know, I love that. I love that show.
Yeah. And I obviously content is very subjective. People like what they like and people don't really like. I think they've kept up the quality bar pretty well. I liked Home too. Trying's a really cool British comedy. It's their first British production. I think that's great.
We're watching
like a light comedy
as a family.
Yeah, it's a light comedy about a couple who are trying to have a kid, but the woman can't bear the child because she's infertile. So they go down the adoption agency route, and it's just a great like 8-episode comedy.
It's so much funny and like
it's
heartwarming,
right? And that got some pretty good critical success as well. Home Before Dark was like a light drama type thing, like a, you know, like a kids. It's not really a kids mystery. It's like kind of a family friendly mystery, even though it does address adult themes. Probably divisive, but I liked it. I thought it was cool. And we've just started Defending Jacob, which is their current like premiere series. You know, starring Chris Evans, and it's like the Chris Evans' child is accused of murder, and there's a big, you know, whodunit. Is it true? You know, who's hiding what? And that's currently ongoing, and that seems to be getting quite a lot of buzz, just like on Twitter and stuff. I think there was a Deadline report that was out today that said like Defending Jacob's like close to the performance of The Morning Show, which is obviously Apple's most successful series, and partly because it's, you know, got the biggest names in it, and secondly it came out on November 1st, so it was kind of like, you know, the start of everything. So if you can match The Morning Show's performance, it shows the service is growing for something that came out in April, if you know what I mean. And that probably is boosted up by everyone's in lockdown as well, but you know, they're taking advantage of the situation.
Did you see Phil Schiller's tweet today? Somebody asked him what his favorite show on Apple TV Plus was.
Oh, did he say For Mankind?
Yeah. I feel like Spielberg got snubbed there. Because you would guess,
yeah,
like
Amazing Stories was I would call it the worst thing they've released this year. It didn't do very well for me. It was definitely a flub. I like sci-fi stuff, but the just episodes were just too dry and boring. Like they weren't interesting enough to hold your attention.
People are a lot of fun with making fun of the name for that reason alone.
Yeah. So I guess the summary of the TV Plus article is basically just like they're on course, right? It's not a failure. It's not a wild success. They're doing this. They're getting up there. It's just a waiting game. Apple has enough money that it can take. They can take, you know, 2 years to build up a library before it, you know, a library of significance. The next big test for the service, of course, is when the second seasons of For All Mankind, The Morning Show, like their big C, their big premiere things that came out started in November last year. When those second seasons come around, the question is how many people come back and actually engage with second seasons, right? Mm-hmm. Because that's ultimately how you maintain a service, is that because when the second, so say it's successful, when Morning Show season 2 comes out, you get all the people that watch season 1 to come back and watch it, plus you get an upswell of people that come to the service in general because people watching season 2 comment on it, tweet about it, and then more people join in. And so that's how you actually, like, you know, get that kind of exponential growth of a streaming service. And so if the content's good enough, people will come back. There are, you know, COVID-19 is causing issues for Apple's plan at the moment, because I think it was pretty clear that they wanted Morning Show to be ready right around November, which is right around when the free trials start expiring, right? Same with For All Mankind. And at the moment, all of their flagship shows are on hold, because all TV production is on hold. maybe they'll do something where they release like the episodes they finished, because I think like Morning Show was like halfway through. For All Mankind had like a month left from production, so you might, and this is going to affect the TV industry in general, right?
Yeah,
like,
everywhere.
Apple problem. Everyone's having issues with this, so maybe you might see them release like 4 episodes in November, and then they'll get back to work and release the rest, you know, early in 2021, which is not what they were originally planning to do, but you know, they've got to adapt to the situation.
Yeah. Network TV does that, like where they've got half a season, then a winter break, and then the next half of the season, for the same reasons. Well, not for the same reasons, but
yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I can't. I mean, I will stick around. I think it changed to the 4K. It changed to the annual plan. Is there one for TV Plus? Yeah,
there is one for TV Plus. It saves 2 months. So
that was at the door. Yeah. So I changed to that one as well, because I knew from the first round of content that I was happy enough to see, like, I want to see the next, you know, seasons of this stuff.
Yeah. And I expect they'll do some like free promo deal, because at the end of the year, they're going to have about 50 shows, right? Which is not quite enough to really have a service stand on its own, in my opinion. And so I think they're going to have some replay, because the 1 year free you get with any device purchase doesn't extend if you buy 2 devices, right? You only get it once. That's what they've announced so far. But I imagine sometime in the September time, they're going to have a new deal, which maybe is like for the whole media bundle. If that's ready, maybe they do an extension. If you buy another new Apple device, you get another year of TV Plus. Like, I think they're just going to have to push it out a bit longer and then try, you know, for actually getting monetization at the end of 2021 kind of time frame when they have crossed the 100 show mark. I just don't think at the end of the year they can really get away with it. Maybe they're going to try and we'll see how well it goes. But I would imagine that if you're renewing, like us, right, we're going to buy Apple devices, right? I'd imagine they're probably going to have another free promo of some description.
My guess would be maybe if you didn't take advantage of the offer last year, that they just extend it. And then if you buy a new device this year, then it works out. And if you did it last year, then it's up to you to stay around or not. We'll see.
That is obviously like all they've announced to date, right? Like, I would be surprised if they don't do some offer promotion where people who already got the free year can get another free year, something like that. Because I think, as it stands right now, they don't have enough content to compete with Disney Plus and Netflix and Hulu and stuff. They have great shows, but you just need more of them, right? Like, and you don't need to. And this is what everyone gets to me when they come at me. They're like, "Oh yeah, but you're never going to get to Netflix's amount of content that comes out." Like, and you know, Netflix releases like 40 shows a month often, and of course, Apple is never going to go for that play. They've shown no interest in it, and I don't think they need to, right? You need, you know, a decent stack of content and a decent stack of shows, but you don't need like 40 a month. If you can get to one a week, one new show a week, I feel like that's a pretty good clip that can keep people engaged. It has enough new content to keep people interested. And if you're selling, you know, $4.99, $5.99 a month, you can keep people around, right? Like, I don't think you have to go to the Netflix levels of numbers of shows. And they're going to get there on their current path if they carry on like that, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah.
Anything more on TVs?
So TV app sucks, right?
you can go read why if you don't agree. Yeah, it's compelling. Yeah.
So TV Plus, I'd give it like a solid 7.
Out of 100?
10.
Out of 10, okay.
Yeah.
Well, there you go. I want to mention a few things with Watch Time this week before we head off. One is that there's a new episode out this week with developer Rahul Mehta, and it's kind of fun. He released a new app on the podcast. So hit the button, go, and now it's out. It's called Activity Stats. And so we talk about that in the episode. We also talk about something I teased before, which is the 9 to 5 Mac Watch Time podcast, Virtual 5K. And now that we have the June 22nd WWDC date, I now know how that will go and how you can get one of those 9 to 5 Mac stickers I mentioned before. So be subscribed before June 17th, because in that episode, I will announce how we're doing that. And we've got a kind of a cool, sophisticated way that involves his app Tempo as to how we're going to make this possible. But the 5K will be on June 23rd. So the day after the keynote, presumably. And it'll be, you know, an hour on Watch OS 7, basically, you know, cause it's the Apple Watch podcast.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, so that'll be a thing. And there'll be some other cool perks to that as well. So check that out. On my other project, spaceexplorer.com, I just want to give a little bit of a roundup of some things that have happened this week. And it's kind of fun with you, Mayo. Did you know that NASA and SpaceX are sending actor Tom Cruise to space on a SpaceX rocket to the International Space Station to film a fiction movie.
I did not know that.
Yeah, it started out as there's a reporter for Deadline who had like the mini scoop earlier this week, and it was like it's really early stages, and there's no film company behind it yet, but like this is the thing that's going to happen, and it'll be the first time.
It's nonfiction?
No, it's fiction. So there's okay. there's been nonfiction on the space station, but it's like filming there with the astronauts. This will be sending an actor on a SpaceX.
So rather than doing it on a set with like CGI, they're going to do it for real.
That's right. So Tom Cruise will presumably have to train to the minimum level, and then, you know, we'll be qualified as an astronaut and film this movie on the space station.
Interesting.
Yeah. So that's a thing. But that was the rumor. And like the first comment was a SpaceX employee anonymously saying like, there's no way it's going to happen. This is baloney. You know, it's just not possible. And then the next day, NASA administrator Jim Bridenstine just had a tweet that was like, it's true. You know, it's like, and then it wasn't that clear that, you know, that Tom Cruise will go to space to film the movie. It was just that there will be a movie filmed on the space station with Tom Cruise in it. But then a NASA spokesperson confirmed to CNN that, no, he's going to space on a rocket and for the movie. Like,
wow.
So that's, you know, and the whole idea there is that it's a high profile actor who will be able to kind of spread the, you know, like, for decades, NASA's worked with film companies on, you know, getting things correct and right and everything to drive the mission. And this will be just like that, plus filmed in space. So that's going to be fun. And then the last thing there is just on May 27th, there's this big historic mission to send American astronauts to the space station from the U.S. for the first time since 2011 when the space shuttle ended. So I'll have hopefully some fun stuff in the lead up to that on the site. And it's also the first time SpaceX has sent humans at all on one of their rockets. So that's going to be a cool thing.
Nice.
Yeah. So I'm hoping to get astronaut Garrett Reisman back, you know, to do a thing before that. We've been in touch. And a friend of mine, we're going to talk about some of that stuff too. So it was one day this week where there was the trailer for Space Force on Netflix with Steve Carell, you know, and it's coming out like 2 days after that launch. And then there was like the confirmation of the Tom Cruise thing, which is just like bananas. And then and then there was the first trailer for a show called The Right Stuff is coming on Disney Plus. That would be like a perfect fit for Apple TV, but like, you know, they've at least got For All Mankind you know, squared away. So everyone's kind of got their space content, you know, good. So that's what I've got this week.
Nice.
You can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Apollo Zach Benjamin. You're on Twitter at
BZMAO.
And you blog at
BZMAO.com.
Nice. And with that being said, we will be back next week. Bye, everybody.